Okay, I'm ready to receive questions of all sorts about my talk.
The first one, okay.
Hello, my name is Arnaud Baguet from INS Lyon. So you start with the Einstein-Hilbert term, to which you add a whale term, that is conformal invariant. However, unless you are in dimension 2, the Einstein-Hilbert term is not conformal invariant, right? So wouldn't you need to start from something that is conformal invariant and then get the Einstein-Hilbert term from the spontaneously broken conformal invariant symmetry?
The answer is no, because I do it differently. And the theory is going to be made first conformal invariant, you could say by brute force, by adding powers of the omega field. So the omega field, the little omega, and the little omega here, let me see, it has a conformal dimension. So it transforms non-trivially on a conformal transformation, including this R term in its kinetic term. So now, whenever you encounter something that doesn't have the right dimensionality here, you multiply it by powers of omega to get the right dimensionality. The thing we do want, however, is that those are positive integer powers of omega, so that the theory looks renormalizable in terms of the omega field itself. So here, you just multiply by omega, because remember, G is downstairs, so perturbation expansion would then be in powers of 1 over omega. But we're not going to do perturbation expansion that way. So we have omega squared here in the numerator. That makes it conformally invariant. So I don't have to do anything else than just that. And then, actually, that is implied by this way, because if I would substitute G mu nu by omega squared G mu nu hat, then this omega squared automatically appears here, and in my next slide, you see what happens. So the entire Einstein-Hilbert action becomes renormalizable, but as you see, it has powers of omega in the numerator because of that. That makes it conformally invariant. And then the cosmological term has omega to the fourth, and so on and so forth. So, but the point why your question is very well posed anyway is that now the kinetic term for the G hat field disappears altogether. That can't be right. So basically, I'm replacing the kinetic term for the G mu nu field by a kinetic term for the omega field, and that leaves the physics invariant. The physics has not yet been modified by this operation. So so that's the procedure. But then I lost the kinetic term for the G hat field altogether. And then I said, well, then I put the quadratic while term, and that is conformally invariant. Yes. Mike.
Michael Duff, Imperial College. Naively, when you make a field redefinition, the physics doesn't change. So you could equally well have not made that change of variable. But then I would be faced with the fact that the world wasn't conformally invariant. So what's wrong with that?
Well, I do change the physics, but in a secret way which I have not yet explained, that will be alluded to more tomorrow. But the thing that changes is that I insist on having only pure powers of omega and not logarithms and fractional powers and so on and so forth. If you would renormalize the theory first and then add in the omega field, I could get logarithms all over the place, or fractional powers or whatever, and I don't want those, because I want the theory to be also to stay a renormalized theory in terms of the omega field. In particular, when omega goes to zero, if omega goes to zero in the previous slide, you would see that then G mu nu goes to zero. That means you're talking about the small distance limit. But in the so-called renormalizable interaction here, omega goes to zero seems to be a totally regular region. That's where I change the physics. To say that when omega goes to zero, nothing should happen. And that means that this theory is not only going to be conformally invariant, I'm going to be sitting at its fixed point. That I'll say more about tomorrow. I think I said some things about it. No, I didn't really say much about it yet today. But so and then I make a solid departure from standard physics. So far, you're quite right. I changed nothing. This is just a field redefinition.
Simonello?
Yes.
Yes. Here. So I got kind of confused between slide 15 and 16. I believe that you start in slide 15 saying that we were going to see the same G mu nu but different omega, and then we end up having also different G mu nu, and I lost the passage there.
I see.
I think that was... Maybe
I didn't say it quite clearly. It is G hat which transforms together with omega. So the original G mu doesn't change, but G hat changes.
I see.
And so I now made transition to use G hat as my formal metric rather than the old G mu. And then, of course, the black hole is going to look totally different. And then the thing is that the original theory was very singular when G mu went to zero or when you went to a very small distance limit. That means omega going to zero. And just in the previous question, my answer was that omega to zero should not be a singular limit at all. So now for the black hole, that gives you the payoff, that now the black hole becomes much more regular because of this extra thing. This is where I change the physics. And that includes the physics of the black hole.
Okay, thank you. Savitsky?
Mykola Savitsky from DESI Hamburg.
Where are you?
I'm here.
Yes.
Hi. Today you mentioned that for the kinetic term, counter term should be added to the Bayer Lagrangian. And basically this reminds me of the picture in the quantum field theory with Fadeyev Popov ghosts. And these are corresponds to non-observables or non-physical objects in the quantum field theory. So in your theory, does this correspond to some kind of physical observed object or not? And what can be the case?
I'll talk much more about ghosts tomorrow because for one thing there will be negative metric states. And I'll explain how to understand those negative metric states and to understand indeed that they are a problem. So I haven't done all my work, not yet I hope, but I still have a problem with those negative metric states. The Fadeyev Popov ghosts is something else. That they only come about when you fix the gauge by introducing derivatives in the gauge fixing condition. Then the Fadeyev Popov ghost pops up and does its own thing as other negative metric particles. So there you know that they should cancel out against the gauge artifacts that you get anyway. So so I haven't really considered much the Fadeyev Popov ghosts on the theory. They are coming right on top of the other ghosts, which are much more problematic, which I'll discuss tomorrow.
Zubenko?
As a warm-up example, we could consider a three-dimensional gravity. In that case, the theory is much more simple because there is no propagating gravitons, and in fact due to that it is renormalizable, but it is still non-trivial. There are BTZ solutions and it's not clear what quantum gravity is, and does what you were talking about tell us something in that case?
2+1 gravity is a completely different theory from my point of view. The standard way of dealing with 2+1 gravity, it's still not renormalizable. But then you can play some tricks that it looks renormalizable, but actually it still continues having problems. When you discuss it in the way many people have been doing, for instance, Karlip and Witten, I think, and various others, the problem is there, the first thing to do is leave out matter. But when I do 2+1 gravity, I see that all the physics in the matter fields now, because the gravitons have 0 degrees of freedom. The gravitons just represent locally flat space-time. They are not physically observable. They are ghosts altogether. So when you say 2+1 gravity is renormalizable, you are talking about a theory which, to my taste, is a pretty empty theory. There's no matter. and there's no gravitational force. There are topological non-trivial structures in that theory. That's
yes, it is topological, but there are non-trivial global solutions. So
yes.
It's not clear how to deal with with global structure in quantum gravity.
Right. So that theory has a quite different physical structure than the 4 plus 1 dimensional case. The procedure I am applying is very much dependent on dimension. So dimension 4 is very special. In dimension 5, I wouldn't know how to do it because I would get omega to the 3 half powers in the Lagrange. No, to, I don't know, but to the third power, I think, rather than omega squared in my Lagrangian. Or maybe I would have to put omega to the third G mu in instead of omega squared. I don't know exactly how I would have to do it. But I haven't really thought about it because the whole procedure is extremely dimension dependent. 4 dimensions, I think, is very special for gravity also. And what I'm going to do tomorrow only applies to 4 dimensions. So 3 dimensions is too trivial a theory in a sense. 3 dimensional gravity, of course, for that reason is very interesting because I said too trivial when I stand on this leg, and I said impossibly difficult when I stand on this leg. So there's something very strange going on with 2 plus 1 gravity that would require perhaps its own program of renormalizing it, which Carlip and Witten have been trying to do. But I would like to put matter in that theory as well, and then again ask the same question. And usually the first thing they do is throw the matter away, and that's a too easy way out to my taste.
Okay, thank you.
Golitsky?
Hello. I have to ask a question. What is the origin of the problems with renormalization in gravity? So, when you want to renormalize the electroweak theory, the base idea is that you can't measure bare charges, and you can measure only the charges with interaction with the vacuum, the all orders of the expansion. And this is the clear and simple physical idea, and it is enough to renormalize the electroweak theory. Why it is not enough and we have some problems in the gravity?
Oh, because I wasn't handling electroweak theory. I was discussing the old electroweak theory of Fermi, where Fermi knew that there were two currents interacting, but he did not know there was a Young-Mills structure behind it at all. So that was before we had the Young-Mills structure. And then the theory was non-renormalizable. And the question was, how do we renormalize the weak interactions? The answer was, you can't. For the same reason as you say now, for gravity, it doesn't work. So the scheme you talk about bare charges and bare fields and so on doesn't work for gravity because Newton's constant in standard gravity has dimension. So if you look at the one-loop corrections, you have get corrections not only get Newton's constant squared, but you get also factors k squared, which means that the integrals are going to diverge more and more if you go to higher energies. So the counterterms needed in gravity do not have the same form as the Einstein-Hilbert action, but in fact have the form of the Weyl squared and onward. If you do it perturbatively, you get Weyl to the third power, Weyl to the fourth power, and so on. And if you don't look at conformal invariants, you get all the other Riemann tensor components raised to very high powers indefinitely. So that, in the standard way of phrasing what renormalizability means, we say gravity is not renormalizable. You could also say it is a question of taste whether gravity is not renormalizable, because you can also say, well, okay, fine, just add all those counterterms. They will each come with their unknown coefficients. Well, then gravity is a theory of physics with an infinite number of unknown coefficients. If you're not afraid of that, you can say, I can renormalize gravity. But most people don't like theories which have an infinite number of freely adjustable parameters. That's what happens with gravity. So I'm not sure I answered your question correctly. But
yeah,
thank you.
Prochaska?
Hi, here. So I wanted to ask you about the 4D Lacton interactions. When you wrote the, I believe it's slide 14, where you wrote the Weyl tensor squared term. Yes, here.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't you have also terms which come from the Euler density? Because the Euler density is not conformally invariant, so in general you can get four derivative, four dilaton interactions. Why can you neglect them in this picture?
Well, first of all, the Euler density is a topological term, so it does not affect the local equations of motion, nor does it affect any quantum corrections or such. It's a topological term.
Mm.
So one can ask the same thing about the electric weak theory, whether you add fundamental topological twists. So there, if the topological twist is locally regular and globally has the correct boundary conditions, then there's no objections against them. But in gravity, you could ask, first of all, do we need topologically non-trivial spaces? In ordinary physics, like us standing in this room, I think our surrounding space is topologically trivial.
Yes, but you talk about black holes. So if there are singularities,
My point was that black holes now also become topologically trivial. So, only in a sense, because in the large black hole limit, they are topologically very distinct. But if I'm not mistaken, well, the black holes in this picture certainly will not contribute to the Pontryagin number or so, because the Penrose diagram will be the trivial Minkowski diagram now, so that has no topological twist in it of whatever form. So even black holes are topologically non-trivial in this case. So I don't see topology entering physics in this theory up till now, but the theory is not yet finished at all. So maybe if someone finally comes with a complete formalism, they say, hey, wait a minute, we see topological things happening. But as you said, a topological winding number doesn't seem to be conformally invariant itself. So that suggests that you can probably weed them out in some way in the theory and succeed in describing a theory without topological invariance. But I'm not sure of this. I haven't really thought enough about the winding numbers, always suspecting that I first need a theory without any topological winding numbers and then worry about topology at a later stage.
Somehow, also second question. So this is all classical scale invariants, conformal invariants. So when you add couplings, there are also beta functions. And there will be counterterms which will depend on these local charges. And these are...
That's a very important point. It's all in tomorrow's lecture.
Okay.
So yes, there will be beta functions. And yes, you have to do something about them. And in fact, the only correct answer will be, look at the fixed points. So where the betas vanish. So, but that will be a very important constraint. And I can already say now that that the theory, if it's the ordinary standard model placed in there, does not obey those constraints. And I say, hey, that's interesting. It means that we have to do something about the standard model. We knew that all along, but now we know for sure that the standard model is not the ultimate truth of the world. You're going to have to add other things. For instance, replace it by a grand unified theory. But whatever you do, you have to try and find out a fixed point of these beta functions. And that's going to be a very complicated and difficult job.
Okay.
Bell'Antuono?
Yes.
Hello. So, the conformal symmetric black hole, we said that has not a horizon with a singularity inside, but is like a soliton, a locally regular soliton. So, my question is, can we, for this kind of black hole, define the analogous of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, even if we don't have anymore the horizon? Or can we define something analogous?
Okay. The thing is, if you look at if you look at the regular magnetic monopoles that come along in grand unified theories, which I was talking about before, those monopoles also, not really carry entropy, but they carry lots of microstates as well. Microstates in the sense that you can have excitations on these monopoles. For instance, you give them electric charge, they become dions. You can give them angular momentum, and they become rotating magnetic monopoles. So, spinning monopoles. And all those, so there will be very many states, and you could call them particles. You can also say, well, they form one collection of microstates for the monopole. And the microstates of a black hole will enter exactly the same way. But now, of course, What still has to be shown in this theory, and I have been not able to show, is that the microstates will build up the same way as required by the Hawking radiation expressions, the Hartle-Hawking ideas. That will still have to be shown, but for sure this thing will have microstates. The question is how many, and that I don't know.
Ivaninsky?
Hello.
Where are you, sorry?
Here. You mentioned that ingoing and outer spectator of black hole can define the vacuum differently. Therefore, it seems that excitation of that vacuum also can be defined differently. Can it help us to resolve problem of information loss when we speak about some microstate, which also can be considered as excitation of vacuum?
Well, that is nearly the same question as the previous one, that yes, this black hole will have microstates, and yes, those microstates should now be completely finite. So in the conventional black hole, the microstates always tend up to form an infinite lot. If you try to reproduce the microstates from ordinary quantum field theory in the vicinity of a black hole, you find a limitless number of microstates, which can't be right, because that conflicts with Hawking's result. So you have to have only a finite number of microstates. Well, if we now look at very small black holes in this picture, I just see them as totally regular soliton-like configurations. And so from that point of view, it would be very surprising if I would still have any infinity of this sort. But what I really consider as a black hole information problem is the fact that the number of microstates seem to tend to infinity if you apply background quantum field theory. So, of course, background quantum field theory is not correct here, but the problem is people are very much inclined to apply that theory, and then you definitely get wrong answers. So the big problem is how to do this right, and that's the black hole information problem. So the problem will certainly become something totally different in this theory. I suspect it will be completely resolved, but that still has to be shown.
Farnos?
Lukas Farnos from Wuppertal. Probably you will answer this question tomorrow anyway, but you thought about this negative metric state.
Which
consequences would they be? Why is that problematic?
Oh, negative metric states tell you they give a violation of unitarity. So instead of the equation that you have unitarity with, where you have the sum of the intermediate states, here you generate intermediate states which, from the Lagrangian point of view, look like completely legal intermediate states. However, they contribute to unitarity with the wrong sign. So suddenly, the theory generates states which contribute negatively to the equation of the sum of probabilities being conserved. So, or if you have a scattering event, the sum of all the probabilities of all the final states adds up to 1. Because you include that nothing happens as well, and then the probabilities add up to 1. But now you have the contribution of some states minus the contributions of other states. That minus sign, I'll show tomorrow how that comes into this theory. And if nothing would be done about it, it would be disastrous for the theory. So it would no longer allow you to do decent looking calculations. So something has to be done about it.
Okay. Thank you.
And the last question from Tokareva.
Hello. You described the black hole without singularity in conformal gravity, but the conformal symmetry must be broken. How would black holes look like in a theory with spontaneously broken conformal symmetry?
Well, the whole thing is, of course, the word spontaneous. Spontaneous means that the vacuum state doesn't obey that theory, that symmetry. So different observers will identify different states as being their vacuum. So the ingoing observer will say, well, space-time around me is vacuum, I see nothing. And the outside observer says, hey, wait a minute, while you were jumping into the black hole, I see all these Hawking particles come out. That's not the vacuum, that's a state full of particles. So they both disagree about what should be called the vacuum state. Now suppose that you normalize omega to be 1 for the vacuum, then I say, wait a minute, which vacuum do you mean? And so the ingoing observer will use a different vacuum to describe his space-time than the outgoing observer would do, because the outgoing observer would include the Hawking particles in his description of space and time. Therefore, he would normalize something else to be 1. So his omega will automatically be a some multiplication, local multiplication of the previous omega. And so and that's where this theory of the black hole differs from the previous theories. The omega behaves such that it tends to zero in the interior region of the black hole, which means the interior region of the black hole collapses to a point. It should go back to the previous metric, as seen by the outside observer. Some people call that a firewall, but it's not really a firewall at all, because the ingoing observer has no problem. He goes into the black hole and still thinks that that there's a singularity lying in front of him. But the outside observer says, no, no, all that space of time has to be replaced by a point, and there is no singularity there anymore. My omega field, okay, looks very wild, but not singular at that point.
Okay, thank you. And one more question. What may be the effects of non-unitarity for black holes? May it lead to some instability or singularity?
Okay. To my mind, black holes ought to behave according to the laws of quantum mechanics. And that means they should contribute to unitarity in the usual fashion. So once we write down a full Schrödinger equation for the theory, that Schrödinger equation should only contain states with positive metric. If it doesn't, then the theory goes haywire. That first step, how to correct that, I'll explain tomorrow. So that's the easy part, but then the problem reappears somewhere else where I don't know what to do about it unless something is done by about the theory. But there's a complication, let me say that right now, that when you talk about unitarity, you also talk about energy. And in fact, instead of having a non-unitary contribution to the states, you could also say I have a negative energy contribution. And now energy is a problematic notion in the case of a conformal theory, because energy is transformed into something else by a conformal transformation. So we, strictly speaking, we don't have a Hamiltonian anymore. So once you say these things, you see how dangerous the whole familiar concept is going to be in the case of conformal quantum gravity. So this is why I suspect that taking conformal invariance into account properly might solve the problem. But without that, the problem is very serious. It also applies to black holes. Black holes should only be described by positive energy states and positive metric states. Otherwise, my theory would be in deep trouble.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we run out of time, and we also finished the question.
Thank you.
So we can thank Professor Tofter.